Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Corti in Washington, D.C.
Almost overwhelmingly, the disappearances are happening to political opposition, to critiques, and it is very, very sad because only a very few percent of them ever get found.
Prominent clerics in Tanzania call for an immediate end to abductions and killings in the East African country.
We fought vigorously to make sure you won the election 2021. This man came out on air worldwide, saying that he is one of the members, he's one of the people who join hands with other people to rig an election. That's a national threat.
The Secretary General of the Gambia Action Party demands an inquiry into claims of rigging in the 2021 presidential election.
So as Congress, as we go into 2025, we want the government to broaden the tax base where they don't only rely on the working few, but the other players in the economy, the mines themselves and other investors. There must be no less tax coming from the mines.
And the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions calls on the government to adopt a more inclusive economic policies to improve the lives of workers in the coming year. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Prominent clerics in Tanzania are calling for an immediate end to abductions and killings in the East African country. In their Christmas messages, Benson Bengoza, Msafiri Mbilu, and Emmaus Mwamakula condemned what they said were the spate of killings and warned that, quote, the shedding of innocent blood always demands justice. It comes after opposition and civil society groups called on the government to ensure the protection of citizens. Local media quote security officials are saying investigations are underway into the alleged abductions and killings. Maria Sarungi Tehai is an activist and a political commentator. She tells me that if the police fail to maintain law and order, there could be an increase in politically related violence during the coming general election in Tanzania.
I think that the bishops actually are not giving anything new. This is something that has been the focus and the discussion for 2024. In 2024, around July or August, the Tanganyika Law Society, which is the Bar Association of Tanzania mainland or Tanganyika, gave a list of over 80 people who were abducted in Tanzania over the past several years. Almost overwhelmingly, the disappearances are happening to political opposition, to critiques, and it is very, very sad because only a very few percent of them ever get found or go back or appear somewhere. Usually they're always associated with the police. Recently, the disappearances have gotten very violent. We've seen the political killings of Ali Kibao, who was a member of the opposition party Chadema, and who was abducted or taken forcefully from a bus, a long-distance bus, in front of witnesses by plainclothes men armed to the teeth in unmarked vehicles. And within 24 hours, he ended up dead, found on a beach. The society has been actually more and more agitated about it. There has been demands, but very little has been done about it.
Some people are suggesting that with this call from these revered priests, perhaps a new focus will be on the disappearances and their call might be listened to by the authorities. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with that. The fact that it is coming from very respected religious people could be one of the most important moves so far. We have seen a lot of the appeal coming mainly from the opposition, which has seemed to fall more on deaf ears. The response so far from government has been that we're still investigating. We have seen recently that there has been attempt to abduct a businessman, but that has failed because the society has started to stand up and protect those who are being abducted. In one case, it turned very violent, whereby one person was killed because the people were throwing stones. The government eventually said that this young man was with the government and he was a revenue authority personnel. Nonetheless, it seems that for now, abductions have sort of slowed down, even if not completely disappeared, because the society has started protecting itself.
Some people are expressing concern that with citizens taking the law into their own hands, it could create chaos if the police does not maintain law and order. Where do you stand on that?
I agree that the rule of law is imperative in order to upkeep the society in terms of keeping the law at bay. That means that most of the time, people in Tanzania have been known to take care, and I'm putting that now into quotation marks, of people like petty thieves. So it is very common for petty thieves, if they are caught red-handed stealing, the society around or the community would stone them to death or would even put them on fire. And there's been a campaign, it has been decade-long action, and there's been, of course, vigorous campaign, including from human rights advocate, saying that this is, of course, unacceptable and people should not take the law into their own hands.
What are your expectations of the coming year regarding human rights and the respect of the rule of law in Tanzania?
I think 2025 is going to be worse than 2024 because 2024 had local elections, but 2025 is going to have general elections, which includes the election of the president, the members of parliament, and the councillors. And I think that that is going to be a very big reason why we're going to start seeing more and more election-related violence or political-related violence.
Mariah Sarungi-Tsehai is an activist and a political commentator. She spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The incumbent president of the Cameroon Bar Association is calling for the group to unite. This as attorney Mba Eric Mba prepares to seek a 2-year mandate to lead the group representing lawyers in the Central African country. Mba says under his leadership, the bar has established an archive as well as reactivated the association's malfunctioning website, as well as instituted a digital professional card for all lawyers. The election is scheduled for January 18. Nominations are yet to be opened for the top leadership of the Lawyers Association. Mba Eric Mba, the current president, spoke to me about his expectations for the Cameroon Bar Association in the coming year.
We are at the dawn of a new era at the bar, meaning we are at the verge of an election. We are at the end of our mandate. So supposing, presuming, and hoping that I am given the opportunity to lead the bar again, the first thing, my expectation is that I expect to see a more united bar, a more focused bar. And given the fact that we have a pyramidal structure of the bar, more about 60 or 70% of the Cameroonian bar is made up of the younger ones who are clamoring every day for better working and living conditions. Mm-hmm. I expect to see that continuous legal training is put in place, which will definitely enable these young ones have the competence to practice, have the competitivity, even at international levels, so that they can be able to make it more than they are doing today.
I know you are trying to seek a second year mandate, but what is your vision for 2025?
There is a lot I have done because, of course, you know, the mandate is 2 years renewable. So there are a lot of things we've started which we need to complete. About a week ago, we laid the foundation stone for the bar office, which we call the bar house, because it's not just the bar office that is going to be there. It's a 10-floor building, 4 on the ground, the ground floor, and 5 structures. So it's a building that is implanted on 1,300 square meters. And the vision, I am the vision bearer. We've just started it, and I think that it will be normal that I have a second term to at least even get the skeletal done or finish at some point. We started the digitalization of the bar. We put in place a professional ID card that has a lot of components. First, it is intended to chase away the charlatans. It's intended to fight all the guys who come into the legal practice who are not lawyers. It has a security code, which is wonderful. It provides for lawyers easy access to some of the services of the bar. With the professional card, you don't need to come to the bar head office to ask for an attestation of professional practice. All you need to do is to click on the button. You need to request just on the split of a second. It is sent to your email and you print it at that level. We've done a lot in terms of training by laying the foundation work. And at this point, we've negotiated with partners national and internationally. So the second mandate will only be to kickstart professional training.
There were concerns recently when one of your members were attacked by the gendarmes or the security operatives. And people are saying that the bar should be more forceful when it comes to protecting its members because it looks like some security agents do not respect lawyers. What is your reaction to that?
No, I think it is not the core as an institution, but there are just some overzealous individuals. And for your information, the bar is very, very hard on it. When the issue happened, I know you're talking about the Tamfu case. When it happened, the first thing is that I condemned it with all the energy. I immediately convened a bar council meeting. The bar council met, and because the Secretary of State for Defense in charge of the gendarmerie had said he should be given the report of the investigation within 72 hours, we said, okay, let's wait and see what 72 hours was going to produce. But unfortunately, Barrister Tamfu could not give his statement within the 72 hours. And the Secretary of State invited us and told us that he himself, in all energy, condemned what had happened and that he was going to take drastic measures. And we told him we were waiting to see that those guys be sanctioned. And the two gendarme officers who were seen in the car smarting Tamfu, both of them have been transferred. Both of them have been transferred. They have been removed from the groupement, which is actually the judicial train of the gendarmerie, and they've been sent to the Mobile and sent to some other town. Secondly, both of them were served a 10-day disciplinary imprisonment term. You know, with the military, they have their internal disciplinary system. Both of them were sentenced to 10 days each imprisonment term. And their salary for the 10 days that they didn't work was cut off.
Attorney Mba Eric Mba is the president of the Cameroon Bar Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a top official in the U.S. Agency for International Development says the organization will continue to provide assistance to those affected by the conflict in parts of the country's northeast. Solani Kodi, the head of the agency's International Development Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance, recently traveled to Eastern DRC to highlight the urgent humanitarian crisis in the region. Among the issues she addressed while in the DRC were food insecurity and gender-based violence. Her call comes as both local and international rights groups blamed the M23 rebels for scores of civilian deaths and large displacement of unarmed civilians in the northeastern DRC. In a wide-ranging interview with me, Solani Kodi echoed feedback from victims of the conflict who she adds want the violence to end. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
Talking about the conflict that has to end, how were the responses of these residents whom you interacted with concerning food insecurity and what the USAID is helping to address the situation there?
So what I heard from residents who I had the privilege of speaking to is that they really need to feel secure in order to go back to their homes. And right now, with M23 still controlling a large amount of territory, they don't feel secure. So I think until there is a resolution to this conflict, until people feel like they are secure and safe in going back home, they're just not going to do that. And so, you know, we very much need to have you know, regional players and heightened diplomatic efforts to create the conditions that people feel safe in going back home.
Talk to me about gender-based violence, because several civil society groups have expressed concern about the violence by various armed groups targeting unarmed civilians. But the issue has always focused on gender-based violence because it's the women and children who get the brunt of these violence that usually go on. But let's also talk about gender-based violence and what you witness on the ground, the responses from residents when you interacted with them.
Thank you for that opportunity to highlight this. And really what, the best way to tell you is to tell you the story. And I had the privilege of meeting a group of adolescent girls who had experienced repeated gender-based violence and sexual violence and rape. And they had small children and infants with them. And there was no father in the picture, and they had either all lost their parents to the violence or they had been abandoned by their families for getting pregnant in the first place. And this is just a pure tragedy that these young girls have experienced this kind of violence and abandonment at an age when they're so young and they should be in school and they should be looking towards their future. And instead they are trying to recover from repeated acts of violence and abandonment. What I can say was a little bit heartening was that we did have partners on the ground who are supporting these women and these girls through a number of ways. One is just counseling and creating some community for them. Another way is to create livelihood opportunities so that they can learn a skill, they can earn a little bit of money for them and their infants. And then this way they're not, forced to, go out to the forest to gather firewood all by themselves and leaving them vulnerable, or otherwise forced to, trade sex for money or just to survive. So we hope that these programs provide some hope and some support. But what is really troubling is just how pervasive this is for the women and girls living in this region.
So, Nali, before you go, will the USAID continue with its engagement and trying to help address some of these challenges you witnessed firsthand in Congo?
We certainly intend to continue to support the people of Congo, and we will do everything we can to work with other donors and other partners, both in the region and, of course, the UN, NGOs, and local partners that are doing everything they can to support their communities and hopefully see better days in Eastern Congo and an end to this conflict.
Solani Korde is the head of the USAID's International Development Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance. She spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. The Mo Ibrahim Foundation has released its latest report on its review of trends and stories, including elections, based on its African Governance Index in 2024. It comes after 12 countries held polls during the year, with the last one, the general election, held in Ghana on December 7th. But four countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, South Sudan, and Guinea-Bissau, postponed elections. The Mo Ibrahim Foundation notes that new leaders were elected in six countries this year. In a 13th election, the self-declared Republic of Somaliland also saw a new leader take office. The region is not recognized as an independent country and is considered part of Somalia. For more about the research, I reached Nathalie Delapalme. She is the chief executive officer of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
Talking about participation and civil society challenges, I know in some countries, concerns have been raised about the spaces for civil society shrinking in some African countries. Can you talk to me briefly about this?
Yes, indeed, you're right. Actually, here again, sadly enough, in most of these election countries, if I can call them that way, participatory and democratic measures have fallen. And this, of course, is concerning. If I look at the 17 countries under election in 2024, we have witnessed deterioration in these participatory measures in Algeria, in Botswana, in Burkina Faso, in Chad, in Ghana, in Mali, Mauritius, South Sudan, and Tunisia. And in all these countries, deterioration has been worsening, or the rate of deterioration has been worsening over the second part of the decade. You also witnessed deterioration, you have witnessed deterioration between 2013 and 2014 and 2023 in Comoros, in Mozambique, in Namibia, in Rwanda, and in Senegal. The only country where the situation of avant governance has improved are Mauritania, we spoke about it, and to a lesser extent, South Africa and Guinea-Bissau. In these two countries, even if the level of participation is better in 2023 than it was in 2014, it has begun to decline since 2019. So this is to watch. The only one where the trend is really good is here again, Mauritania.
Talk to me about media freedom and rights, because in some countries, a lot of civil society groups and media organizations have complained about crackdown. Talk to me about media freedom and rights in the year 2024.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Actually, we've looked more closely at the 2 years leading to election in 2024, which was what happened in between 2021 and 2023. And what we see is that media freedom has been restricted between 2021 and 2023 in 15 out of the 17 countries. So this is, of course, a matter for concern. The most dramatic fall is to be seen in Burkina Faso, followed by Tunisia, and also, to a lesser extent, Senegal. All these three countries have registered declines in media freedom that are above 10 points.
Now, let's look at positive democratic shift, since the continent appears to be embracing democracy in spite of some slip-ups in other countries, briefly.
This is indeed an interesting trend, I think, and a hopeful trend. What I would say is probably we need to look at it a little bit more closely. We need to reflect on democracy, what it means, but also what is the best system. I'm saying that because for the time being, the indicators we are looking at are executive elections, most of the time, executive elections held, well, quite some years apart. Democracy is also a system that probably works even better now at local level, because it's dealing also about daily life. So we need to consider democracy at local level. We need to see whether in between elections every 5 or 7 years apart, to what extent it would be useful to hold more regular consultations, because this is also democracy. And this is definitely something that the young people, and you know that on the African continent, 65% of the population is under 25, are looking for. So what comes out of this of our analysis is that democracy is far from dead in Africa, and far from, a lot of people are talking about growing mistrust in democracy. Our analysis would be that it's not a growing mistrust in democracy as a value. On the contrary, the majority of African citizens are very much attached to democracy, especially among the young people. What they do not trust as much is the system that's currently still, you know, sort of most used when we talk about democracy. Once again, executive elections every 5 or 7 years doesn't summarize democracy as they hope it. But once again, I think that the belief that the system can need to change is still there. And the vitality, especially among the young people. And Afrobarometer surveys, we work a lot with Afrobarometer, do point to the same conclusion.
Nathalie de la Palme is the CEO of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. She spoke with me from the French capital, Paris. In The Gambia, the Secretary General and party leader of the Gambia Action Party, or GAP, is demanding an urgent independent inquiry into claims that the presidential election in 2021 was rigged. Musa Osenu Yali Bachili also expressed concern the alleged electoral malpractice remains a potential threat to national peace and stability. His remarks come after a former supporter of the National People's Party, or the NPP, claimed in an interview that he was part of a team that rigged the last presidential poll. The NPP has rejected the allegation, saying it is without merit. Musa Osenu Yali Bachili tells me that citizens must learn to recognize and reject misinformation. He says the accusations are baseless and can exacerbate political tensions and potentially destabilize the West African nation.
Look, somebody generally came out. He shot himself on the foot, saying that he was one of the members who joined hands to rig an election. Like, I supported President Barrow. I was one of the coalition members of President Barrow. We fought vigorously to make sure he won the election 2021. This man came out on air worldwide saying that he is one of the members, he's one of the people who joined hands with other people to rig an election. That's a national threat, my brother. Even those who supported Barrow, now I have a doubt immediately.
Does that mean that there should be an independent investigation to find out whether what he's saying is true or not?
Exactly. There should be an independent. If I'm urging President Barrow to take a real task force to investigate thoroughly of this, there must be a thorough investigation to make sure whatever he's saying, is it true or lie? So that whoever supported me, I want to be clear. I don't want to involve in any political party or any institution, any organization where there's people join hands to reject an election. My brother, that's a serious allegation. To be honest, I'm really angry.
Are you worried? More so,
I'm concerned. I'm not worried.
Are you concerned that the coming election next year could also be tainted with such statements? Is that what you are saying?
The statement, what he said, is a concern. That means if it's true, that means we're all involved. People who supported them, we find ourselves as a guilt. I want to know the truth because I've really supported my wholeheartedly. My resources, my intellect, my people, my support to win. And I believe he won the election clearly, fair and clear.
That the statement, in your view, taint the electoral victory of President Barrow in 2021?
Yeah. If this man came with the proven evidence and the whole enter the investigators find out he's telling the truth, then this election another election will be set up immediately. Hear me clearly, because I'm being heard all over the world. If this statement of this called Mr. Drama is proven to be right, then this is a dangerous thing in our country. Then our country is going wrong. Is going in a direct election, and this election, then President Barrow didn't win the election. We have to go back to another election again. It's sad. This is about Gambia. This is not about a political party called NPP. It's not about a political party called GDC or UDP, APRC, or my political party GAP, or PIDA, or others. No, this is about the interests of the country.
Musa Osenu Yali Bachili is the Secretary General and party leader of the Gambia Action Party, or GAP. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. The Zambia Congress of Trade Unions, or ZCTU, is calling on the government to adopt a more inclusive economic policies to combat inequality, boost productivity, and improve household incomes next year. Blake Mulala, the president of the union representing public workers, says reforms such as broadening the tax base and reducing what he says is the 37.5% tax burden on workers will help promote equity. His comments come as workers express concern about the tough economic conditions and a lack of pay increases to enable them to feed their families. For more on the union's calls for the government to help ease the economic pressure on workers, I spoke with Blake Mulala.
The unions, when they go to bargain, we bargain, and what gives us the more reason of our bargaining is to look at the rising cost of food. And then we look at the food basket for a family of five or six. When the projections say the food basket has gone up annually, we should be also be able to go and bargain on the table based on the rising food price pay liberation, which are always released by the youth center. Now, we have the highest tax band of 7.5%, which workers falling under this tax band, they have to pay. So when out of your income, if it's a 7.5% has to be gotten away in taxes, it means that the workers remain with less disposable income, which can help them. So as Congress, as we go into 2025, we want the government to broaden the tax base where they don't only rely on the working few, but the other players in the economy, the mines themselves and other investors, there must be no less tax coming from the mines.
Blake, some people are suggesting that you are not pushing the government hard enough to increase the wages of public sector workers, because they said if a lot of tax waivers are given to some of these companies, they are heavily taxed, it creates an unequal system, and they are unable to feed their families. How do you address that?
I think it will be a misperception, because remember, we are dealing with a government which inherited a debt, and that they had to do some restructuring for them to be given a chance to attend to issues of the economy. And during the bargaining, yes, in a bargaining process, it's not the winner takes it all, but it's a win-win situation. And when the public service union were able to get a 500 kwacha towards the towards salary increments for the public service workers, I think that's the best which they could get given the current economic challenges which the country has gone through. You may wish to know that we have been hit by drought, Peter. Apart from the drought which we had hit the country, this had a negative impact on the generation of power, because we mostly depended much on the hydropower generation. And we have had long hours of load shedding, which has negatively impacted on the productivity. So all these issues, it has affected the performance of the economy. And as we bargain as the Congress and through our affiliates, we are mindful that we have a duty to push government. But again, you cannot push a limping government, because what we see is the government which is coming out of a hard situation of a debt restructuring, which has not yet been even concluded with the other lenders.
What do you say to the government, particularly when it comes to electricity power supply? Because some people are saying it is collapsing a lot of businesses. How are you engaging the government to address this particular problem?
The national energy crisis, Peter, I agree, I think government has learned lessons. And again, we are going to, as Congress, from the workers, we shall blame it on successive governments who have not diversified because of the over-depending much on hydro electricity, where they need the hydro production most of the time, other than looking into other means. So we have had challenges because of the prolonged power outage. Not only that, but there was also an issue of rising tariffs. These have disrupted the businesses. And not only businesses, but it's affected even households. And the economic growth has not been as expected.
Blake Mulala is president of the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. 2024 was one of the worst years in UNICEF's history of documenting children in conflict. More children than ever are estimated to be living in conflict zones or forcibly displaced due to conflict and violence. Several places in Africa, including Sudan and parts of the Sahel, were places where children's rights were violated again and again. UNICEF's emergency communications specialist Joseph English tells viewers Carol Van Damme that the world's leaders must recognize that the staggering number of grave violations committed against children this past year, 32,990, must stop in 2025.
What we found when we were doing this analysis was that conflicts raging all around the world are having a devastating impact on children. And whilst there are a small number that we see in the news every day, there are also countless other conflicts that are not being reported on with the same level of detail. And so Sudan is very clearly in that bracket. I mean, this is the world's largest displacement crisis for children. It's the world's largest hunger crisis. Just a few days ago, we had the awful news that the famine declaration in Sudan has been extended to other areas of the country. And so for many, many children there, you know, the last year and a half, almost more now, has been defined by heartbreak, by displacement. Many families have been displaced multiple times, either because of the fighting or because they're just not able to get enough food to survive. And it's not being noticed in the same way. And, you know, that is without even thinking of places like the DRC or, as you say, the Sahel, where there is not enough attention on a global scale being paid to these conflicts. And whilst that is the case, it is very difficult to put pressure on leaders to address these crises. Because if we're not there saying this cannot be the new normal for children, then we will continue with the status quo.
What rights do children have? What rights does a child have in a conflict zone?
Children in conflict zones have exactly the same rights as children anywhere in the world. So first and foremost, that is the right to safety and security, the right to ensure that they are able to grow up, you know, without fear of being killed or injured. It also means they should be able to access school and quality education. They should be able to access healthcare. And what we found is that for every single one of these metrics, there are more children affected negatively, so out of school or not able to access healthcare or malnourished, than at any time that we've been keeping these records. And so, you know, what we're asking for is just adherence to the rules of war, adherence to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and making sure that children's lives are not defined by war and by conflict, but by, you know, joy and fun and play and education and all the things that any parent would want for their child.
How many grave violations were committed against children in 2024? I know UNICEF keeps statistics on these kinds of things.
We do. So the total numbers are not going to be released until 2025 because we obviously need to tally everything up. We need to make sure it's all valid and correct. And then what happens is that's released through the annual report of the Secretary General, who works with the Special Representative on conflict, children and armed conflict. But what we have seen is that where we do have an indication of these numbers, such as in Ukraine, we've seen more violations in the first 9 months in Ukraine than in the entirety of 2023. Similarly with Sudan, we've seen an huge increase in numbers. We also expect to see an increase in numbers in Gaza and in often other crises which are just not covered in the same way. So like Myanmar, potentially like DRC. And so whilst the overall numbers for 2024 are not yet ready, what we are seeing is that for everything where we can sort of speak to our technical colleagues and say, are you expecting the situation is getting worse? We're getting better. We're saying it's getting worse.
Describe or explain grave violations.
Yeah, certainly. So there are six grave violations against children in times of conflict that were defined by the Security Council and the UN. Now, these are the killing and maiming of children. It's sexual violence and rape against children. It's abduction. It's the recruitment and use of children by armed groups. And it's the denial of humanitarian access and attacks on schools and hospitals. So all of these are outlawed. You know, these are against the rules of war. But what we see time and time again is these rules are being flouted. You know, it is just, there is, in any military conflict, each of these actions is a decision by a human being, by an individual. And so what we're saying is that these individuals need to be held to account. The people who make decisions about how wars are fought must adhere with the rules which say children should be protected. And, you know, we should not live in a world where we just sort of throw up our hands and say, well, children are going to be killed. They're collateral damage. Oh, well, they're being used as human shields, so there's nothing that we can do. We have to see a just complete global voice saying enough is enough. We cannot continue to see it get worse. 2024 and 2025 has to be the year that we see a change.
Joseph English is UNICEF's emergency communication specialist. He spoke with viewers Carol Van Dam from New York. Countries in Africa have been slow adopters of battery-powered vehicles because having reliable sources of electricity is a challenge in many places on the continent. But some companies are coming up with creative ways of making electric vehicles possible in power-challenged Africa. For VOA, Victoria Amunga has the story.
Onesmus Otieno earns his living making deliveries and ferrying passengers around Nairobi, Kenya's capital, with his electric-powered motorbike. The two-wheeled taxis, popularly known as Boda Boda in Swahili, are commonly used in Kenya and throughout Africa. Kenyan authorities recently introduced these motorbikes to phase out diesel-powered ones. Otieno is among a few riders who adopted them, but he says he regrets his decision because finding a place to charge his bike has been a big headache. He says that sometimes the batteries die while he's carrying a customer, while a charging station is far away, so he has to end that trip and cancel other requests. To solve the problem, a Chinese company, Beijing Sibo, has created a mobile application. Users of electric vehicles can request a charge through the app, and charging equipment comes to the user's location. Lin is a general manager for overseas business of Beijing Sibo.
We produce the equipment so we can control the cost of the product. Then we can deploy the product in anywhere or any country they need it, and they don't need to build fixed charging piles. We can move to the location of the users, and we can collect green electricity for the electric vehicles.
Lin says the mobile charging service vans named Sebo use electricity generated from solid waste and can charge up to 5 cars at one time for about $7 per vehicle. The cost is less for a motorbike. Countries in Africa have been slow to adopt electric vehicles because there's a lack of infrastructure to support the technology, analysts say. The cost of EVs is another barrier, says clean energy expert Ajay Mathur.
Yes, the capital cost is more, the first cost is more, but you recover it about 6 years or so. We are at the beginning of the revolution.
Electric motorbike maker Spyro offers a battery swapping service in several African countries to solve the lack of electric vehicles infrastructure problem. But studies show that for many African countries, access to reliable and affordable electricity remains a challenge. There are frequent power cuts, outages, and voltage fluctuations in several regions on the continent. The Center for Strategic and International Studies describes Africa as the most energy-deficient continent in the world and found any progress made in electricity access in the last 5 years has been reversed by the pandemic and the population growth. Companies such as Beijing, Sebo, and Spyro are finding ways around the lack of power in Africa.
We want to solve the problem about charging anxiety anywhere you are.
The hope is to make electric vehicles more accessible, even if the infrastructure is lacking. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Today we'll deal with the second episode of the Curse of Berlin. This will be the second major international event, and that is the end of what was called the First World War, 1914 to 1918, although that war was mainly on European soil. At the end of the war, a conference was convened at Versailles, almost a neighboring city to Paris. And at this time, the conferees were only three: the Prime Minister of Great Britain, the President of France, and a new participant, the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson. The idea mainly for the conference was to sort out what they should do with the territories that have been wrested from the defeated countries, such as Germany, Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire or Turkey. And the conference was to do what it is that they should do. Of the three conferees, the French president was the one who was full of revenge against Germany because of the way Germany had humiliated France in the 1870 war. Woodrow Wilson was quite different. He was an intellectual who had lectured at Princeton University in New Jersey. Then he ran for president. But he pondered aloud, what is it that many powers should do to end all wars? As an academic, he drew lessons from the 1815 Congress of Vienna at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, where it has been enunciated that whenever there are disputes in Europe, the European states should meet together to what was called the Concert of Powers. So Woodrow Wilson took that and said, okay, what we need then, 1919, is a permanent institution which he called the League of Nations. And they will be able to resolve issues without much further arrangement. In fact, he believed so much ending the war that in 1928, the League of Nations passed a resolution or declaration to end all wars. What Wilson also did in proposing the League of Nations is to issue 14 points or declarations or principles to govern the League of Nations. Of these 14 points, one was extremely important. It says that peoples have a right to self-determination, which means that they have a right to decide how they are governed. This principle, of course, was anathema to the United Kingdom and France, because they don't share that view. And when I do this thought, I will show you how this became a problem when we went to the United Nations in 1945, where this same principle of self-determination was part of the charter. Now, they looked at what should be decided. Mainly, for Africa, they decided that the German territories which have been given to them in the Berlin Conference in 1884-85 should be given mainly to UK and France. For example, Tanganyika was a German territory, and the British got that. Cameroon also mainly for German, and they split it between France and the United Kingdom. In the southern part of Africa, the so-called Southwest Territories, now Namibia, they gave that part to the then Union of South Africa, which was more of a liberal state before the Africans won the 1948 war election and then began the apartheid period. They tried to incorporate the Southwest Territory to South Africa. Even they only have what was called the mandate. They should not tamper with it. Next time I will tell you what the Africans did to fight against apartheid South Africa. So these are the factors which, if you look at all the problems in Africa today, arose from this tempering, what I call the lingering impact of the curse of Berlin. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
It's Masterell on the beat, baby.
It's money since I was 13, tried to be rich before 30. 30 billion in my mind, no one can stop me, cause I'm a hustler. I'm a hustler. I'm a hustler. I'm a hustler. I work hard every day. 9 to 5 just to get my daily bread. Pray hard every day, asking God to bless my way. Troubles may come my way, trials may come my way, but I keep on doing my thing. Nothing will knock me down, down, down. Nothing will knock me down. Depuis le berceau, je visais très haut. Connu dans le réseau pour mes raisons. Gala dans la saison, j'ai pris mes décisions. Moi, je veux l'argent pour cette saison. Cause I'm a hustler. I'm a hustler. I'm a hustler. I'm a hustler. You never give up. If you know things are hard for you, keep your head up. You know one day God will come through. Troubles may come my way. Trials may come my way, but I keep on doing my thing. Nothing will knock me down, down, down. Nothing will knock me down. I walk high. Just to get my daily bread. Pray hard every day, asking God to bless my way. Cause I'm a hustler. I'm a hustler. I'm a hustler. I'm a hustler. Troubles may come my way, trials may come my way, but I keep on doing my thing. Nothing will knock me down, down.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Mogwill Yabaro, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a little rain does not stop the farmer from planting. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.